Okay, good morning, everybody. Anatomy 231, and it is September 8th. And let's just, before we forget, what's happening next time? That's Wednesday. What's happening Wednesday? We've got a test on Wednesday, and who knows what material is covered on the test? Anybody know? Chapters 1, chapter 2, chapter 4, and 5. So we're skipping chapter 3. So 1, 2, 4, and 5. And you've got some good study materials on the web, because you have to know those figures, and that's just going to be free points on the test if you go through those figures a bunch of times. Probably some of you could just maybe do it 3 times. Some of you might have to do a little bit more than that, depending if you're a visual learner or not. And then the other things will be the end of chapter questions, multiple choice, and you can listen to the lectures again online. And I do have a comment about our last lecture. The tape got messed up, but I was able to retrieve it, but I couldn't get it into a compressed format. So it's kind of a big file. It's almost 100 megabytes. So I'm going to have to take that off of the server soon, but I won't do it till after the test. But as soon as the test is over, the last lecture I'm going to erase from the server. So if you want a copy of it, you have to go there and get it or talk to me later in the semester. But you probably won't need it after the test on Wednesday. Okay, so who's found those lectures online? Anybody found those lectures online? Nice. Did anybody find them helpful at all? Anybody? Not too many people. A couple of people. Yeah, give it a shot. I don't know. You've listened to the lecture, so it just kind of reinforces. If you haven't heard the lecture and you don't see the figures, I don't know if you would necessarily learn anything, right, if you're just trying to take the class without coming to lecture. It might help just a little bit, but you can go and listen to that lecture again. So I'll put this lecture up, I guess, real soon, maybe tonight or something. But we're almost done with the integument system. But first, I want to tell you, this is what you need next time. All right, this is a Scantron. Anybody know what kind of Scantron this is? 882, right? Just a plain 882. And across the each of these little bubbles right here are capital letters, A, B, C, D, E, because that's how the multiple choice answers are given to you, A, B, C, D, E. You can buy Scantrons with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 across, but then you have to convert numbers to letters and stuff like that, and that's just too difficult. All right, what's this? Okay, number 2, but this is the most important thing. Eraser. Do you see what kind of eraser this is? It's a good eraser. So it's not going to smudge up things. The eraser on these things, even though it looks the same, the erasers on these pencils are just smudgers. And you're going to lose points if you do that. So get a good eraser, please. Because in order to see your test, you're going to have to come to my office and take a look at your Scantrons. So you're not going to get them back here in lecture or lab. You're welcome to do that. I wish you would do that. But a lot of students just don't have time, don't take time to do it, and you don't learn from your mistakes. And the most common mistake is using a smudger instead of a good eraser. Okay, so please get a good eraser for the test. Okay, so anybody have any questions on the integumentary system? Yeah? Oh, yeah, I'd like to go over the... You know, I maybe put it on my announcement wrong. I sent an email to everybody, and maybe I said weekly study guide, and I meant to say weekly study plan. It was just that one sheet of paper that you're just keeping a note of how often you're studying and when you're studying, so that it's just a way for you to help organize your study time so that you get the right amount of study time in. You're not going to be graded on it, anything like that, but I just wanted to help you as much as I can get organized so that you can put the right amount of time in to get a good grade. So if you want to bring those by, I'll be happy to look at those with you. But you can also work with your lab instructor and go over your study time with them as well. All right, so what did I say on the weekly study plan? Was it 18 hours a week? Okay, that's a lot. That's a lot of time. But if you put that time in, you know, I think you're going to do really good in here. So I would give that a shot first. Yeah. I don't have that right on the tip of my tongue. Somewhere between 50 and 100. I think 50 or less is a little bit too short of an exam. I would like to actually put 50 on there, because then you could use a Scantron twice. But That's a little cheap for me just to give you 50 questions. So somewhere between 50 and 100. The first test may be a little bit less. And then as you learn how to study for the class and take the test and things like that, I probably put a little bit more and more as the semester goes on. So 70 maybe, 75, something like that. So in an hour and a half, that's plenty of time if you know the material. Yeah, question. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Particularly on the reticular layer part, I noticed you put like notes for like things for like descriptions on the first three, but then on the fourth there's like a blank section.
Let me see what we got. Oh, okay. I was just
if you like mentioned something though from like last class that.
Okay, so we're under what?
Reticular layers.
Oh, number five? Oh, no, I just left that off. You know, that was I didn't turn off the automatic outlining function, and sometimes if you're not careful, things will happen automatically. You know, like spell checker will put in a word that doesn't make any sense, and I think that extra line is in there because the outline function was there, and I just meant to put a space, and it turned out to be a whole. Yeah, question. Okay. I couldn't quite hear, so everybody let me hear the question. Yeah.
Where are you taking the test?
Yeah, right here in this room. Yeah. Yeah. So come on in, but you gotta have a Scantron and your pencil and a eraser. Alright? And when you're taking the test, make sure you turn off your cell phones and your PDAs and infrared links and X-ray links and X-ray glasses, whatever, right? Just from your own mind, closed book, no hats or hoods can be worn, or sunglasses during the test. So you just have to take it right in here, and you got an hour and a half, so come on in and relax and just do step at a time. Yeah, all the way in the back. Oh, yeah, because I haven't seen it once yet. The question was, do you still need a picture ID? Absolutely. For this test, I think a driver's license will be okay. But, you know, if you need to check things out of the library, you need a Cypress College picture ID and not a driver's license. And the only thing over in the library that I have for you in the reserve section is the textbook and maybe the lab manual. So you probably don't have to go over to the library very much in this class. Okay. All right, well, yes. There might be a short answer in the way of fill in the blank, something like that. But usually it's multiple choice, true, false, matching, things like that. Okay. So I probably won't ask you to write any long essays on the test. We might save that for the next test. Or drawing. I could have drawings too, but probably not on this test. Okay. Okay. Drawings are really excellent to do. Okay. All right, so we're in the integumentary system, and what are the two main layers of the integument?
Epidermis.
I like epidermis. And dermis. That's right. Those are the two main layers. And what's another layer that we talk about right now, but it's not really part of the integument? The hypodermis. What kind of tissue is hypodermis? It's adipose, yes, loose areolar connective tissue. What's another name? We've got a number of different names for hypodermis. What's another name for it?
Subcutaneous
layer.
Adipose layer.
Okay, adipose layer. I haven't really heard that, but I think everybody would kind of know what you're talking about because we store a lot of fat in that layer. Yeah? Yeah, the superficial fascia. Superficial fascia. So fascia sometimes is a layer between major organs in the body. And what is the biggest organ in your body?
Skin.
The skin, right? And it separates muscles and bones from the skin. So that's why we call it fascia, but it's superficial because why? It's very close to the surface of your body, just underneath the skin. That's why we call it, as opposed to deeper fascia, which is going to separate muscles and organs that are deep inside our body. All right. So let's think of the epidermis for a second. The epidermis has layers associated with it. What are some layers of the epidermis?
Stratum corneum.
Which layer is that?
Top layer.
There's no such thing as top layer. There's no such thing as first layer. It's a layer. Which one layer is it? In terms of anatomical speaking, how would you describe to find that layer? Do you need to get out a scalpel or something and start digging around or what? Superficial is the correct word. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you're right. Superficial layer. All right, since we started on the top layer, okay, I'll just kind of misuse the terminology a little bit, but starting with the superficial layer, what's the next deepest? Oh, okay, I didn't tell you what kind of skin.
Yeah.
Okay, that was bad. Okay, in thick skin, what's the next superficial one? Or the next deeper? Stratum lucidum, and then deep to that is the granulosum, deep to that is a spinosum, and then deep to that is? Yeah, basali. Good. Yeah, basali. Some people say basali. All right. Gosh, you guys know that. That's great. Oh, you practicum. Okay, that's on the practicum. Good. You guys are taking a practicum or have taken a practicum. All right, so that seems a little complicated, but that's not too bad to know those different layers. But you also have to know something about what? What kind of chemicals can you tell me about that you can relate to the epidermis? Keratin. Where do you find keratin? In the skin cells themselves. What's the function of keratin? I'm not sure if I heard anything. Yeah, it hardens the cells. Gives us a little bit of an armor plating. And our nails are an armor plating. We've got to look at nails yet today. That's one of the last things. And those keratinocytes that make up nails are skin cells that have extra keratin and an extra hard form of keratin in them. And give me another structure of the integument that has a lot of keratin. Hair. That's right. Hair does. Has even more. And these are filamentous in nature. They're long columns of dead keratinocytes that form hair. Okay. All right. And then the dermis. How many layers in the dermis? Two main layers. Which is the toughest one? The reticular layer. Which layer is that? I'm going to pick on you because you know it now. Which layer is the reticular layer? Is it the superficial or the deep one? Yeah, it's the deep one. All right, so what is the superficial layer called? Papillary layer, right? Which of those layers is made out of dense, irregular connective tissue? Reticular layer, that's right. It's almost a little bit of a misnomer, right? It's not a reticular connective tissue. It's dense, irregular connective tissue, but we still call it reticular because it has a network of collagen fibers. Where do we find collagen? What part of that tissue? It's a connective tissue, but we can break a connective tissue down into two main areas, two main compartments. Any kind of connective tissue has two main compartments, and where are we going to find the collagen? In the matrix, right? You have the cellular part of connective tissue, and then you have the matrix. And collagen is in the matrix. It's in between the cells. Oh, I asked. Well, no wonder you guys knew the answer. So you weren't reading that? Okay, good. Okay. It wasn't up there. All right. Well, you might want to try this sometime. Let's see if it works. I tried doing some of this the other time. Here is an integument tutorial that I have for a Bio 160 class. It's not quite at the same level as this class, but it goes over some of the basic features of the integument. So you might want to watch this sometime. Let's see if we get an error message. I think it's going to... Oh, but I don't know if we have sound. Let's see if we have sound in here. Okay, so you remember that web page? And you can just click on that tutorial. I'll try and have some other tutorials for you later on in the semester. Ah, it's there. Oh, but there's no picture. Okay, on your computer, I think you'll get the picture, as well as the sound. Okay, so check it out. Let me know if you can get to it. I think you can get to it. I have no idea why it's not showing up. Is it on this? Oh, it's on the screen here. It's just not on this monitor. Okay, so anyway, computers, sometimes you have to mess around with just a little bit to get it working. But All right. So if you want to do a quick review, you can do a quick review of the integumentary system there. Huh? Yeah. Here. It's what's on your syllabus. sdm.cypresscollege.edu/TildeJGober. And it's just on the first page. Okay. Yeah, it's there all right. I also have it in the 160, but you can get it off the front page. How's that? And I think I sent you an email with this web address in it already, so you probably don't have to copy it down. You can just copy paste or just click it. Probably control click in the email or just click it in the email, and you should be ready to go. Okay. So what do we still want to look at today? Some glands. Let's look at some glands. And we see that there are two main kinds of glands in our body. And there are sebaceous glands and sweat glands. Sebaceous glands secrete a compound that we call sebum. All right, it's a holocrine, there's my cursor, holocrine secretion. That means the whole cells break apart, and that goes through some kind of duct system, and it moves up to the surface of the body. And this is the kind of material that lubricates the skin, prevents dehydration, and it's a bacteriostatic agent. It's not an antibiotic, but it attenuates or prevents, to some degree, the growth of bacteria on our skin. So that helps fight infection. All right, so sebum is an oil. The second kind of gland that we have are what we call sweat glands. And sweat glands, another name for sweat gland is sudoriferous glands. And we can see a couple different kinds of sweat glands right here. The most common kind is what we call a merocrine gland. Sometimes some books call it an eccrine sweat gland. They're open to the skin surface, on the palms of the hands, soles of the feet, and your forehead. They secrete mostly water, but they also secrete some salt. And that increases the conductivity, the electrical conductivity of your skin when you start to perspire, right? Because there are ions in there, little electrical particles, and they can carry electricity very easily. And that's the basis of, does anybody know what that forms the basis of? When do you start to sweat? When you're put in kind of a difficult situation,
stress
for instance, and most people when they tell a lie, they feel a little stress, and that stimulates those sweat glands, and that increases the electrical conductivity of their skin, and that can be measured pretty easily with instruments, and so that's the basis of a lie detector test. Okay, polygraph test, that's right, a polygraph test. So, we could do an example of that in class. Does anybody want to volunteer for a polygraph test? No, let's not do that. Okay. All right, another kind of sweat gland is what we call an apocrine sweat gland. These are open to hair follicles in the axilla. Where's the axilla? Armpits. All right, genitalia, external ear. They secrete a thick organic secretion. And body odor is a result of bacterial action on these secretions because what? These oily secretions have energy content. Salt and water have no energy in them, so that they don't really promote bacterial growth except for the water. All right? But bacteria can't get energy from these materials, but bacteria can get energy from these organic secretions. And normal bacteria fauna on our bodies is a very good and healthy thing and probably prevents a lot of pathological kinds of infections that we could have. All right, so that's an ecological issue. All right, another kind of gland is a ceruminous gland. They secrete cerumen into the external ear canal. Maybe you don't know where that is yet. Maybe you do. All right, we're going to learn where that is pretty soon. All right, that's a modified apocrine gland. And that is, the common name for that would be earwax. It secretes earwax. And some people have more active ceruminous glands than others. And as a matter of fact, some people actually have to go in to see a doctor every so often and get that earwax removed from their ear because what happens if you get a big plug of wax in there?
Can't hear.
Yeah, you can't hear very well, right? So that should be removed. And Actually, hearing is kind of interesting, I think, from the standpoint if you still have grandparents, a grandma or grandpa, right? And as we get older, our hearing kind of decreases anyway. But if for some reason we lose our hearing prematurely, or even as we just normally grow older, that can be a cause for irreversible senility. When people can't hear, they just have a tendency to tune out, kind of using that euphemistically. They stop listening to their environment and interacting with people. And that's really kind of an unfortunate thing, because it can be treated so easily with hearing aids, or maybe just removing some cerumen from somebody's ear can prevent early onset senility. So that's kind of an important thing to kind of be aware of, right? Because we like our grandparents to stay active and alert and all that kind of stuff. All right, and mammary glands. These are modified sweat glands as well, but they produce milk. All right. Nails. Talk about nails just a little bit. I think that's almost our last topic here. All right, so a nail, it's a thin plate of dead stratum corneum cells filled with hard keratin. And we have some parts of a nail that we should look at. So let me just go to here's a sebaceous gland that you can see emptying into that hair follicle right here. All right, so here is a nail. So here is the free edge of your fingertip. And so this we call the body of the nail over here. This little flap of epidermis right here, we call that the epinicium or the cuticle. And then you have this little light area underneath the nail, that's the lanula. And then what kind of view is that going to be? Okay, but if you look at the front, this could be on the test. If you look at the front, what part of the hand are you going to be looking at? Okay, anterior. So this is actually a posterior view. All right, so don't forget anatomic position. Because which way are the thumbs pointing? They're pointing. Got to be careful. Got to use a correct anatomical word. Is what? Starts with an L. Lateral. Yeah, they're pointing laterally. All right, but if we have a nice sagittal section right here, all right, we see the free edge once again. Here's the body of the nail. And then the nail bed under here, which is vascularized. And there's the epinicium. Here's the proximal nail fold. And deep to the proximal nail fold, we have the root of the nail. But the root of the nail is still not alive. These are dead keratinocytes. And a nail grows not from the root, but something that's even behind it, right? And that's what we call the nail matrix. So that can be a tricky question. Yeah. Oh, fingerprints. Don't see any on this slide, but for instance, I'll go back in just a second and I'll tell you where that is. All right, so don't forget this particular point. All right, this is the newly forming nail right here. This is the root of the nail, but it's not really growing from this area. It's actually growing from what part? The nail matrix, right? So this is the part that's getting blood supply, that's undergoing mitosis, and then the nail grows out in this direction. So you can damage a nail, the body of a nail and the nail bed and even the root of the nail, and the nail is going to grow back, chances are, just fine. But if the nail matrix is damaged, then that nail won't ever grow back again. Okay, so I know some people get a fungal infection in the nail bed over here, and it's very difficult to treat because it's not very vascular. And so the way they treat it is by removing the nail and using the systemic and topical antifungal agents, and then you can get at the fungus and hopefully be okay after that. Yeah?
What happened when my son broke his thumb? I mean, his toenail.
Uh-huh.
And it didn't grow back the way it was
before. I don't know. So it cracked like in this direction here? It must have damaged maybe this little area right here of the nail matrix, maybe. Okay, maybe that rip went all the way down and actually separated the nail matrix right here and created a little scar tissue, for instance. It's kind of, there's a bump right there. I would say that the nail matrix was damaged and it formed a little sliver of scar tissue right there. Yeah. And I don't know if that will ever go back to normal. How old was he?
Two.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty early. That might go back to normal eventually. Okay. But there's a lot of other parts of his body that are still growing pretty rapidly, right? So they're competing for all those things, just like his fingernail right here. All right. Well, let me go back and show you where those dermal papillae are again. I think this is an okay slide to look at that. Or fingerprints. Fingerprints, what kind of skin do you have fingerprints? Thick skin. Palms of your feet, palms of your hand, soles of your feet, palms of your hand. And don't forget, you have these dermal papillae, and these dermal papillae are projections of the papillary layer into the epidermis, and that forms a little ridge on the surface of the skin, and they're continuous, and that's what forms fingerprints on our feet and in our hands. And you sort of can see them on the models that you have in lab, those big plastic models of skin, which you might not even look at anymore. Okay, so that's where fingerprints come from. These dermal papillae right here. Okay. Yeah. The nail matrix? Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, you have bleeding under there, and so you'll have a hemorrhage, and that hemorrhage will grow out. It will kind of be incorporated into the nail bed, and that will just grow out to the free edge as well. Yeah. And just like when we're talking about a blister, if you ever get a blister from use or a burn or something like that, I don't think I would remove the fluid from that area right away until it kind of calluses over. So if you have a big hematoma underneath the nail plate, it's maybe a good idea to leave it there for a couple of days, and then somebody might actually decide to remove that fluid because it might impede the growth of the nail and just form a lot of pressure that will be pretty uncomfortable. But I wouldn't remove it right away. I'd let your fingertip kind of settle down and protect itself from infection. That would be the thing I would be concerned about, infection. Because we do all kinds of stuff with our hands. Uh-huh. Yeah, because when the new nail starts to grow, it grows underneath the old nail that was damaged, and then the new nail is going to push it right up out of the way. And so it's going to fall off, or you can yank it off after a month or so. Okay. Yeah, who had a question? Yeah.
Yeah, so when in regards to blisters,
yeah?
There's usually the one where it's like, you have like something like, I don't know, like, kind of like stuck somewhere on the inside of the skin, or like kind of like a piece of wood or something.
Well, if you have a foreign body, I would remove that from your skin because that could cause an infection. And a nasty infection, it can cause a nasty infection. I heard of one case where it almost killed somebody.
Now, would that also like be the same case, though, for, like if you actually got like a slight burn, though?
If you have a burn, I would kind of leave it alone and let it heal. I wouldn't go digging around in there. But a foreign body, I would remove and watch it very carefully. And if it turns red or if you get a temperature, go see a doctor right away.
Because
any kind of puncture wounds are kind of dangerous these days because of MSRA. They're difficult to treat. Okay, so don't leave anything in your body that doesn't belong there. Yeah?
What causes your nail to turn black if you slam against the door?
Sure, you've broken blood vessels underneath the nail plate and especially in this matrix right here. And they're going to bleed until they clot off. And it might take 30 seconds to a minute or so for that blood to clot, and that blood has no place to go once it leaks out of those blood vessels, and it just stays there, and it, you know, turns all these cool colors eventually, purple, blue, black, you know, and then eventually it will grow out. Yeah, so it's blood, it's a hemorrhage underneath the nail that causes that. Yeah, don't slam your fingers indoors. I hate it when that happens. Okay. Oh, all right, so let's move on a little bit. I couldn't quite hear that question.
I just heard one ago, I heard sometimes that on the cable that there's certain times where it sticks on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you don't want to rip the epinicium from the nail plate. So some hand lotion or something, right? Your skin is just drying out. And Guess what happens as you get older? That gets worse. Okay. So let's talk about some of those things. What about functions of the integumentary system? Well, protection, right? So we said protection against what? Water loss and infection primarily. And of course, melanin. What's the function of melanin? Protects you from sunlight, right? So the integument is very important. Hair protects you from cold or from heat. It's an insulator. Eyebrows and eyelashes protect your eyes from foreign bodies falling into your eye, or they'll trigger a blink reflex so that you'll close your eyes before those objects go in your eyes. And you have hair in your nose and ears, and again, that prevents foreign objects from getting in those canals. Nails protect the tips of your fingers. I probably would have lost a fingertip here and there if I didn't have nails on them in the course of my life. And of course, for defense, right? For fighting, protecting young, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And another real important function of your skin is temperature regulation. And when you're hot, your blood vessels in the integument vasodilate. That means they get very big. So they carry a lot of heat to the surface of your skin, and then you can radiate that heat away if it's relatively cool outside, or you start sweating and that evaporation cools your body down. And when you're in a very cold place, then you have vasoconstriction. Your blood vessels in your skin constrict, and then you retain that body heat to your core areas of your body. All right, let's see, what does it say? When your core temperature is above 98.6, what's 98.6? That's normal body temperature. When we get into a physiology class, you're going to say, that's a set point. Set point, your dermal blood vessels, are they vasoconstricted or vasodilated when you're at 98.6? Neither. They're just basically normal, right? All right. The skin is also important because it helps produce vitamin D. So you need sunlight, and that's going to produce a precursor to vitamin D that's inactive, but that precursor can be used by the liver to make an active form of vitamin D, which is necessary for absorption of calcium and phosphate in your diet. And of course, you need calcium. Where do you need calcium? Bones, that's one place. And teeth. And you're going to learn in the next year or so that's really a magic molecule. You need it for lots of important things. And one of the last places that you really need it is your bones. But you got to have it in your bones nonetheless. And then, of course, for sensation, skin is real important for sensation to communicate with your environment. Pain, heat, cold, pressure, vibration. All right, so that's pretty much it for the integumentary system. Sue, let's move on to next chapter. And the next chapter is going to be bones. I think that's six. No. Open.
Can we review?
Sure, I'll be happy to answer any kind of questions that you might have. And we can discuss some of these things. Yeah? Like what? Oh, I did want to do something here. Hold on, I can review a little bit. I can review something here for you. Okay, did you guys have to know anything about mitosis? Yeah, I think we talked about mitosis in here. All right, what are two important functions of mitosis? Why is there mitosis? Growth and repair old and damaged cells. So that you should have on the tip of your tongue. Just don't say reproduction, because mitosis is reproduction. That really doesn't help, but growth and replace old and damaged cells. All right, so I'm going to show you some pictures, and you should tell me what phase of mitosis that this particular cell is in. So the active phases of mitosis, what are the active phases of mitosis? Yeah, so there is prophase. What comes after that? Metaphase, and then? Anaphase and? Telophase. What happens during telophase? Cytokinesis, right. All right, so let's look at some pictures. So this is a stain of a cell. So here's a centriole here, and this is a centrosome complex and a centrosome complex and microtubule. So this is what we call a spindle apparatus. And so that's what, yellow or orange, or what color is that?
Green.
Green. Okay. But now these blue things, are they blue?
Yes.
Okay, these blue things don't have anything to do with the spindle apparatus. They are chromosomes. That's the DNA inside the cell. So that's what you're looking at on this slide. And what can you tell me about all these chromosomes? Are they just randomly arranged all over the cell? No, they're lined up right smack in the middle of the cell. So what phase of mitosis is that? That's metaphase, right? And of course, there's no nuclear envelope. And I think I can almost see like the boundary of the cell right over here. And you can see intermediate filaments and microtubules where? Pretty much all over the cell, defining the shape of the cell. All right. So what stage of the cell cycle are these cells in? I would say interphase because I can see nuclei in there. Wrong one. I can see nuclei inside these cells. There's a nuclear envelope, so that means it's not mitosis. It's something, so this is just the growth phase. And when I look inside the nucleus, I really don't see chromosomes. It all looks homogeneous. The DNA is pulled off the chromosomes. It's what we call extended, and it's being used to make RNA at this point in time. So this is a growth phase of the cell cycle. This is interphase. And this phase right here, yeah, I see the spindle apparatus, but now I see a separation between these chromosomes. So the sister chromatids are being pulled apart. That's going to mean that this is either anaphase or telophase, but I only see a small space over here and a long way to go before they get to the centrioles. So this has got to be anaphase. So anaphase. And now this phase right here, I see the spindle apparatus beginning to form a little bit, and I see two centrosome complexes, and maybe they're starting to separate. And inside the nucleus right here, I can almost begin to see chromosomes. It's not just a blue smear of material. I can see chromosomes condensing a little bit. So I would call this early prophase. And now this one. Yeah, the chromosomes are pulled way over to the centrosome complex. And I even begin to, so here's an outline of the cell, and you see this little dimple right here. And that dimple continues all the way across the cell. So that's actually a little furrow in the cell. We call that a cleavage furrow. And so the cells are separating. What phase of mitosis does the cytoplasm separate into two different cells? That is telophase. And the process of the cytoplasm separating is what we call cytokinesis during telophase. All right, also during telophase, what could happen is that the nuclear envelope reforms and the condensed chromatin starts to be pulled off of a chromosome. It's being used to make RNA once again, so it gets to be extended. So those are some characteristics of telophase as well. And then here is... Yeah, that's probably interphase. I don't see anything that looks like a chromosome inside the nucleus right here. Okay, so that would be a growth phase. And then this one right here. Do you see any chromosomes?
No, it's late. Isn't that late chromosome?
Okay, well, wait a second. Let's think of my first question first. Do you see anything that looks like a chromosome?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what color are they going to be? I don't usually like using color, but this is good for us here. They're blue, right? Those are those thick blue filaments. So here I see a chromosome. So the chromatin is not extended. It's condensed. So this is an active form of mitosis. But I don't see any kind of arrangement. I just see a random pattern in all these chromosomes right here. So this is a very early phase of of mitosis, so this is prophase. Okay, but it's later prophase because I don't see any nuclear envelope. The centrosomes are on either side of the cell, so this is a later phase of prophase. And the microtubules are attaching themselves to the centromere, which is the center part of each one of these chromosomes. So early prophase. And then this one. Okay, that's metaphase because all those chromosomes are lined up right in the middle of the cell. All right, so let's go through this one more time. Maybe two times. We'll see. All right, so you tell me what phase it's in. What's that?
Interphase.
That was interphase because all the chromatin is extended in all those cells. I would say the chromosomes are just beginning to separate. That's anaphase. Prophase. That would be early prophase. We'll do this again. Early prophase, or we can go back because I can see just some condensation of the chromatin. All right, ready for next one? Telophase. What else is happening? Cytokinesis. What's another way of thinking of cytokinesis? If mitosis is the separation of chromosomes or sister chromatids into two daughter cells, what's cytokinesis? Separation of the cytoplasm, which means what? All the organelles get separated into two daughter cells. Oh, what was that? Interphase? Oh, I don't have a rest place in between these two. Ah, okay. Late prophase. Yeah, late prophase. I should have stopped here. Okay. Ah, metaphase. Let's go back. Metaphase. Metaphase. Interphase. Anaphase. Prophase. Early prophase. Telophase with cytokinesis. Oh, okay, this one right here. Late prophase. Oh, I got to go back and modify this. Okay. All right, so those are some things about mitosis. Let's see if I have anything in here worth looking at. Ooh. Okay. Gigantic rough endoplasmic reticulum. Yeah, question. No, not for my test. Okay. Yeah. But you should know all the characteristics, like the centrosomes are moving, the spindle apparatus is being built. Two more things for prophase. What else happens during prophase? Nuclear envelope goes away. Yeah, the nucleolus or nucleolus disappears and the chromatin condenses. So that's what happens during prophase. Okay. Okay. All right, so that last organelle, what was the function of that last organelle? Protein synthesis. All right, what's this? Oh. Yeah, lysosome. I see particles inside there. All right. I don't think this is in your book, this particular figure, so I won't put this on the test, but you can see a bunch of junk inside this vesicle right here, so it's a lysosome. It's a little bit of an artistic license. All right, that is the nucleus and the nucleolus, and this is extended chromatin, so this is what it looks like during what phase of the cell cycle? Interphase. Do I have two? Oh, this guy right here, mitochondria. I don't think this is in your book either, but you have something similar to it. Mitochondria. What's the function of the mitochondria? Make ATP. Centrioles. Smooth endoplasmic reticulum, Golgi apparatus, sperm, but the organelle per se is flagellum. All right, this just shows a secretory pathway. Proteins being made by the rough ER go to the Golgi for modification and packaging, and then they're packaged into vesicles which end up inside a vesicle inside the cell, or they're secreted outside the cell. And that is the plasma membrane, phospholipid bilayer. And this one you don't know, but this is a peroxisome, and there is an enzyme in here that detoxifies a harmful product of metabolism called hydrogen peroxide, and the enzyme is called peroxidase. And so this just maintains the health of the cell. But this is another vesicle inside the cell. Oh, what was that? These are just ribosomes. We got free ribosomes, and then ribosomes attached to endoplasmic reticulum. What's the function of all these different ribosomes right here? Protein synthesis, that's where it takes place. Oh, it's labeled on that slide. That's the cytoskeleton. That's not on the slide, I don't think. Cytoskeleton, right, made up of all these different filaments. Cilia. Yeah, and these are even smaller than cilia. They don't move around. These are microvilli for absorption. And then this is, I guess, where we started from. Right? Smoothie ER. Rough ER. All right, so how about if we just say the function right now, real quick? All right, so don't say the name of the organelle, but the function. Yeah. Digestion. Protects the DNA from corruption. And also the nucleolus makes RNA. That's the active part of the nucleus. ATP production. Organizes the microtubules. Lipid synthesis. Modification and packaging. Motility. Watch out for that one. That's the secretory pathway. Secretory pathway. Proteins are made in the rough ER. They go to the Golgi. The Golgi modifies, packages them into vesicles, which then can move out into the extracellular material or stay within a vesicle inside the cytoplasm. Ah, what's the name of that process where there is a vesicle that contains something and it fuses with the plasma membrane and these contents are released? That's, yeah, generally exocytosis, and secretion would be another way of saying it, but the process is exocytosis. Phospholipid bilayer, the plasma membrane. Detoxification. Protein synthesis. Cell shape. Moving organelles around inside the cell. Motility. Absorption. Protein synthesis. Okay. All right. So those are, that's all pretty good. So I'm going to, I think that's the only thing I really want to show you as a review. But, yeah.
When you say cytoplasm, is that just talking about the organelles, or is that talking about the cytoplasm?
You know, here's a definition of cytoplasm I like. And maybe it has changed since the book was written. All right, but we have cytoplasm. And cytoplasm is everything that's inside the cell membrane. And you might even include some internal parts of the cell membrane itself, but anything that's inside the cell is cytoplasm. And so cytoplasm has two components to it. It is organelles plus the fluid part, cytosol. So when people say cytoplasm, it should really include all those things. Because you might find something that looks like a cell, and it might have a fluid inside of it. Maybe some viruses might have a little bit of fluid, but they don't have organelles. And so it really doesn't have cytoplasm, because you got to have organelles too. Okay. So that's more of a classical definition. All right, so we're going to move on to bones. And you might have some of your study sheets. So let's look at some bones. Okay, so I think we want to define what makes up the skeletal system. So this is kind of fun because now we've moved from some of the basic material of an anatomy class to where we're going to start looking at organ systems. So from here on out, we're going to start just learning anatomy by organ systems. And we're going to start with the skeletal system, which is a nice place to start because we're all sort of familiar with bones a little bit. Okay. All right, so first we want to look at the components of the what? Skeletal system, the organ system. And it's composed of not just bones, but also cartilage and ligaments. So let me tell you what a ligament is. A ligament is dense, regular connective tissue that's going to connect a couple bones together. So a ligament is a bone-to-bone connection. There's something that's very similar to a ligament. It's called a tendon, but it's not a bone-to-bone connection. A tendon is a bone-to-muscle connection. So, yeah, beware that you know what a ligament is. I'm sorry? Oh, yeah. A ligament is the kind of tissue is dense, regular connective tissue. So you have collagen that is produced in these parallel sheets, parallel columns. Right, dense irregular would be what? Like in the dermis of the skin in all different kinds of directions. So ligaments can withstand tension when you pull on it from long end to long end, but it does really poorly if you pull on it from side to side. The dermis you can kind of pull on in all direction and it resists tension, but a ligament and tendon as well, you should only apply tension on it from either end, not from side to side. All right, so let's take a look and see where we find some of these different components. All right, so here's a skeleton, and we can see cartilage in this particular, and we can see some bone. So we see bones right here, and cartilage are going to be, what, this blue and orange and red. We see that we have a couple different kinds of cartilage in the body, and what I don't see on this diagram are ligaments, for instance. So we see bones and cartilage, but not ligaments per se. All right, so what are some of the functions of the skeletal system? Well, support, all right, we looked at dense regular connective tissue. It can resist pulling, which is what we call tension. All right, but if we push on either end of a tendon, or if you have maybe a fiber or a thread, right, if you pull on that fiber or thread, it's going to resist tension. But if you have that fiber and thread and you push your hands together, you try to compress, what happens to that thread? Does it compress very easily? Absolutely. Yeah, a tendon can compress very easily. Right, just think of take a thread, pull on it, and it will resist tension. But when you push the ends of the thread together, it just collapses. Right, so we can't use dense regular connective tissue for support, because when you press on a tendon, it's going to collapse just like a thread. So there's another kind of tissue that does not collapse, and that is bone. Bone is rigid and it's strong, and it can bear great weight because it doesn't compress. Collagen can compress. Collagen is what? You can't pull it apart. That's tension. So compression and tension are two different kinds of forces that you could apply to different parts of your body. Cartilage, on the other hand, is firm, but it's flexible. For instance, we have cartilage in our nose, ear, our rib cage. And so that's a very nice feature of cartilage, because it's firm, but it can bend. As long as you don't overbend it, it's going to go back to its original location. So it's used in places in the body that's meant to bend or deform. And the other nice thing about cartilage is that it's very lightweight compared to bone. If all the cartilage in our body was bone, we would have to eat a lot more every day, have more muscles to move it around, and we couldn't move quite as fast. All right, so bone is heavy. But it's the nice thing about bone is that it doesn't compress. And during development, bones that are growing grow from cartilage models. So if you're going to have a bone in your body, in some cases that bone is fashioned or formed out of cartilage, and then that cartilage turns into bone as you develop. So that acts as a precursor to bone formation. All right, another important function is protection, like the skull. What's the skull protecting?
The brain,
that's right. The brain doesn't have much in the way of connective tissue, doesn't have ligaments and tendons holding the brain together, and there are no bones really deep inside your head, so you just have this armor plating over the bone, which is the skull. And it's the same thing for the rib cage. What is the rib cage protecting?
The
lungs. Yeah, lungs. What else is pretty good in there? The heart. Okay, liver, not quite, because the liver is below the thoracic cage. It's below the diaphragm, inferior to the diaphragm. like great vessels. If those great vessels break or get nicked or cut or whatever, you could die in just a matter of minutes as well due to a massive hemorrhage. So the rib cage protects a number of very important organs inside your thoracic cavity, lungs, heart, and great vessels. Yeah. Yeah, we're going to look at that. We're going to look at all the different parts of bone. Definitely, definitely, definitely. All right, and vertebral column. What does the vertebral column protect? The spinal cord, which is another part of the central nervous system, right, sort of analogous to the brain. So it's a nice armor column that protects the spinal cord. All right, another function of bones, of the skeletal system, is movement. Muscles attach to various bones, and when a muscle is excited, guess what it does? It contracts. And so it's going to pull a couple bones closer together, and those two bones are joined together by a joint, and it's going to cause motion of those two bones, which we call articulation. So movement is an important function of bones because there are joints where two bones come together. And don't forget, a ligament is a bone-to-bone connection, which is there to stabilize a joint, somehow to limit the motion, or to prevent inappropriate kinds of motions. And we probably all sprained a ligament at some point in our life, like ankles and things like that, right, by inappropriate motion between two bones that really weren't designed to move in that particular way. Did I see a hand over there someplace? No? Okay. So movement is important. And then bones are also important for storage. Storage of calcium. That CA with a little 2 plus above it right there, that stands for a calcium ion. And also phosphate, that P sub I right there, stands for PO4. That's inorganic phosphate. So bones store these ions for our body. And we need these ions for many, many functions, many, many purposes. We can't talk about them all, but probably in about a year or so, you'll learn what all the different functions these ions perform in our body. And bone is a good storage area, a reservoir for those ions. And bones also store fat. In the very core or the very center of some bones, they're loaded with adipocytes, and we call that yellow bone marrow. So bone marrow is the tissue that's deep inside of a bone, and yellow is just one form of marrow. And then lastly, which is probably new to most of us, and that is red blood cell production. So we call that a hematopoietic tissue. Bone is responsible for making red blood cells. And again, it's made in the cavities that are inside bone, and we call that what? Bone marrow or bone cavity. And the kind of bone marrow that produces red blood cells, we call that red bone marrow as opposed to yellow bone marrow. And these produce red blood cells and platelets. So what is a hematopoietic tissue? That's a tissue that makes red blood cells. Did I ever tell you how many red blood cells your body has to make?
Yeah.
Every second? Did I tell you that once upon a time? I asked you probably, for mitosis, I think I used that as an example. How many red blood cells are made every second in your body? It should balance how many die, and it's about 2.5 to 3 million red blood cells every second die. So is this hematopoietic tissue an active tissue or one that just kind of laying around? Very active. Very, very active. Okay. Bone does have nerves, and it's vascular. So if you break a bone, yeah, it can hurt, and it's going to bleed a lot. So that's one of the complicating things with bones. But there's an advantage. If you have a nice vascular supply to an organ or a tissue, what do you think of its regenerative capability? It's going to heal faster because it has oxygen and nutrients to it. So there is always a serious issue with hemorrhage when you break a bone that could be life-threatening, but it also means that bones will heal relatively quickly. Unlike our first topic here, which is cartilage. Cartilage is not very vascular. So it doesn't bleed, but it also means that it doesn't regenerate itself. So that's one disadvantage that cartilage has over bone. All right, and you're familiar with the different kinds of cartilage because we already studied tissues, right? There's hyaline cartilage, elastic, and fibrocartilage. And so now you should be getting an idea of where we find these different kinds of cartilages in our body and what kind of functions they perform, not just kind of what they look like underneath the microscope. All right, so what kind of cell do we find in cartilage? Chondrocyte, that's right. They're going to have chondrocytes, so that's the cell. And where do we find chondrocytes in cartilage? In lacunae all the time. And these chondrocytes will secrete different kinds of ground substance and fibers into the matrix depending on exactly what kind of cartilage it is. Hyaline cartilage is the simplest kind, right? So they secrete a very soluble form of collagen into the matrix, and not thick fibers of collagen, but very soluble forms, and no elastic fibers. So hyaline cartilage, you can't see fibers in. It just kind of gives you a diffuse, translucent look when you look at it underneath a microscope. So where do we find hyaline cartilage? Okay, we find hyaline cartilage in the nose, right? That's nice and bendable. And we see it in the rib cage because a rib cage expands and contracts every time we breathe in. And also, all of our joints, a special kind of joint, all freely movable joints have hyaline cartilage over the ends of bones that protect the bones from grinding each other down because bones are made out of calcium and phosphate. They're sort of like rocks, and if you'd rub two rocks together, they would grind each other down. We don't want that to happen with our bones, so there are smooth articulating surfaces, and they're covered with hyaline cartilage. And sometimes we call that articular cartilage. Articulation is just a joint, so articular cartilage is hyaline cartilage that we find where? Within joints, within articulations. All right, another kind, elastic. Similar to hyaline, but it also contains elastic fibers. It's better able to withstand repeated bending. And that also means that if you don't overstress that tissue after you bend it, what happens to it? It goes back to normal. Like your ear, for instance, is a really good example. And the epiglottis. The epiglottis is some cartilage that you have that separates your airway from your digestive tract and kind of designates where certain material goes. Like, for instance, when you swallow something, where should that material go? Into your stomach. And the epiglottis does a little job, but when you're breathing, where should that material go? In your lungs, totally different place. So the epiglottis helps determine which way certain materials go. When we get into respiratory system, we'll talk about the epiglottis. All right, and fibrocartilage is the toughest. That can resist compression as well as tension. So what are these two terms? What is compression mean? Like if you're trying to squeeze something together, that's compression. And what's tension? When you're trying to stretch something apart, right? So cartilage can resist both of those. But remember, tendons and ligaments can only resist one of those. What can a ligament and tendon resist? The pulling apart, the tension, right? But if you try to compress a tendon, of course it's going to compress because it's just a fiber. Okay. So we say that it's a structural intermediate between hyaline cartilage and dense regular connective tissue. What do we find in dense regular connective tissue? What's the chemical? Okay, what's the cell? Yeah, the cell is a fibroblast and it secretes collagen into the matrix, right? So in fibrocartilage, the chemical is the same as dense regular connective tissue, which is collagen. There are a lot of collagen fibers in fibrocartilage. And one place where we see it is in the intervertebral discs. These are discs between our vertebrae. And there is something called the annulus fibrosus, which makes the outer ring of an intervertebral disc that's very tough material. It can be damaged, but that holds the internal parts of the intervertebral disc in position, as well as parts of the knee, right? A knee meniscus is made out of fibrocartilage as well. And so you can see these different places. So here is fibrocartilage in the meniscus, right? Here's fibrocartilage in the intervertebral discs. Oh, what about this right here? Is that the same color? That's the pubic symphysis. That's a joint between bones of the pelvis right here. It's a pubic bone here and a pubic bone right here. That's a joint. And that's not very movable, but it does move under certain circumstances, like childbirth, for instance, or if you're riding a motorcycle and you get into an accident and you go through the handlebars. That's a joint that kind of separates. And in either case, it probably doesn't ever really go back together the way it was before. Okay. Okay. So that's fibrocartilage. Okay. Bones. Let's see what we should talk about in terms of bones. Types of bones. We can classify bones by their shape. All right. So we have long bones. Now, what the heck is a long bone? A long bone is like a columnar cell. It's big in one dimension, but it's short in two other dimensions. All right, so it's maybe long in the superior inferior dimension, but it's short in right and left and anterior posterior. So in one dimension, it's longer than the others. It might be that it's not a very long bone, it's just longer in one dimension than the other. Like, for instance, this tiny little bone that you have in your fingertip right here. It's not very long, but it is still a long bone because it's a lot longer than it is, what, deep or wide. So it's still a long bone. The ulna is a classical long bone because it's not very thick, it's not very deep, but it's what? Really long from superior to inferior. So we call that a long bone. So you have some nice examples in your textbook. This one right here is not the ulna or the radius, but this is the humerus that we find in our arm. All right, so that's a good classical example of a long bone. And the femur is a nice long bone. We've got some nice long bones in lab for you to look at the inside of, and the femur is an example of that. So these are all long bones right here in the digits. So each finger, anatomically, we don't say these are fingers. These are actually digits. All the bones that make up your digits are long bones. A short bone, for instance, like the trapezoid. All right, short bones. Do we have a short bone? Right here. That's a bone that makes up our wrist right here. That's a short bone because no matter which way you look at it, it's going to have the same length. Okay. Irregular bones, like a vertebra. And they have all these different processes sticking off of them. And so it's highly irregular. All right, flat bones might look kind of long, but in one dimension, they're going to look really flat. So that's a good example of a flat bone. This one right here, the breastbone, is what we call the sternum. And this sternum, you're going to see, has three parts to it. This is the body of the sternum, and then a little joint right here. This is the manubrium. And then some of you might be familiar with this part of the sternum right here. And most of us, it's probably ossified, meaning it has turned into bone. But in young people, that's still cartilage. And that's what we call the xiphoid process. And this joint's not very strong. So for instance, if you're doing CPR, anybody that's CPR trained knows this bone, because when you do chest compressions to beat somebody's heart whose heart is not beating on their own, all right, the xiphoid process can break off, and it's very close to major blood vessels, and in particular the liver, which is right over here, and it can cause some massive hemorrhage, which the patient doesn't need, in addition to not breathing or his heart not beating, right? Okay. All right, so that's classification of bones. Parts of a long bone. This is a nice introduction for parts of a long bone. So I'm just going to go over all of these different features right here. So now we're going to look at just a long bone. And we can see that a long bone has two ends, two opposite ends. And the ends of a long bone are what we call the epiphyses. And the epiphysis that's closest to some center attachment point to the body is the proximal epiphysis. The one that's farther away from attaching to some core area on your body is what we call the distal epiphysis. And the bone that's in between the epiphyses right here is what we call the diaphysis. So the epiphyses are the ends of the bone, and this long shaft is what we call the diaphysis. Okay. What else do you see? I had a question about bones. Do some bones look spongy? Well, here is a nice classical long bone. And if we look inside this long bone, on either epiphysis, we see a real spongy nature to it. And so this is what we call spongy bone. So there are holes inside bone, and these holes are filled with marrow, and you've learned of two different kinds of marrow. There's red marrow and yellow marrow, red and yellow. So if it was red, it would be making red blood cells. If it's yellow, it's just a storage form of fat. And so this is still pretty strong bone, but the medullary cavity allows for marrow to exist in these spaces to perform those two different functions, but it also makes bone very light, so it doesn't cost so much energy to move our bodies around. So it's still strong, but it's light, and it performs those other functions as well. Okay, over the articulating surfaces on the epiphyses, we have articular cartilage. So maybe you can see something that looks a little blue or something right here. That's articular cartilage. That's going to form a joint with another part of the body. But you also see that covering continuing over the whole bone, the whole rest of the bone. So there's a membrane, and that membrane is what we call the periosteum. Remember what you should think of when you hear this term osteum. You should think of bone, right? Like osteocyte, for instance. The periosteum is a membrane that is just surrounding the bone. That's what peri means, surrounding the bone. And that's completely surrounding every surface of the bone except the articulating surfaces. All right, so that's the most superficial layer of the bone, is the periosteum. And if we go a little bit deeper, right, if we go a little bit deeper to the periosteum, we get into something that looks very solid. Doesn't look like spongy bone at all. Doesn't have a spongy nature to it. So sometimes we call that compact bone. So generally speaking, there are two kinds of bone. There's spongy bone and compact bone. Compact bone is, let's look at compact bone right here. I see compact bone right here. And then as we move into the bone, it gets spongy. So where would be a good place for you to look for compact bone, superficially or deep? Superficial, right? So superficial bone is sometimes used to describe compact bone because it's solid, it's not spongy. And then this bone right here is an organ because it has blood supply, has nerve supply, it's connective tissue. So it's an organ, and any superficial part of an organ is what we call the cortex. Any deep part of an organ is what we call the medulla. So guess what? We have kidneys. The kidney has a cortex, and the kidney has a medulla. What part of the kidney is the cortex? That's the outside or the superficial part, and the deep part is the medulla. All right, the adrenal gland has a cortex and a medulla. The brain has a cortex and a medulla. Every organ has a cortex and medulla based on how deep it is in the organ. So another name for compact bone is what? Cortical bone, because it's the most superficial layer. What else did I say? Compact, cortical bone, superficial, yeah. Okay, there's another word someplace in my mind, which I'll remember in just a second. Okay, as opposed to spongy bone is called medullary bone. Because it's what? It's deep to the cortical bone. And it's what's called the deep medullary, okay, or spongy bone. Okay, because it's deep. And then even deeper inside the bone, we have this cavity. Now, would you call that a cortical cavity? No, because it's deep inside the bone. That's what we call the medullary cavity. And that's going to be filled with bone marrow of some kind. And you know two kinds of bone marrow, you know, red and yellow, in this region right here. All right, so this bone during development has to grow. And in order for it to grow, it's got to have a blood supply. So here is a nice artery that's supplying blood. So here's a nutrient artery. And there are holes sometimes that we can see in the bone that allow this artery to enter. And a hole in the bone has got a special name. A hole in a bone is what we call a foramen. That's a weird term. I'll write it on the board, but I think I have a list in your slides. Foramen. All right. And so a foramen is a hole in your body And what's the function of a foramen? It's for, in just one word, it's what we call a passageway for something. So it allows a blood vessel to go through a bone or maybe a nerve or other structures. So a foramen is a passageway. In this particular case, the nutrient foramens are what? Passageways for this nutrient artery to go into the bone to supply nutrients. So bone is a very living tissue. It's very much alive. And it needs oxygen and nutrients to stay alive. And if this artery right here is damaged, guess what's going to happen to this bone? If we cut off blood supply to that bone, it's going to die, just like if we cut off blood supply to your heart's going to die, or your brain's going to die. This bone is going to die, and it's going to dissolve away, and it causes a lot of problems for certain kinds of people. Maybe we'll talk about that sometime. Okay. So, here I see compact bone, spongy bone, articular cartilage, and what's the membrane on the outside of the bone called, once again? The periosteum. Well, you know what? There's also a membrane that lines every interior space or cavity of a bone. We don't call that the periosteum. We call that the endosteum. That's a membrane that's on the inside of the bone. Okay. There are fibers that help attach the periosteum to cortical bone. We call those perforating fibers or Sharpie's fibers. Guess what kind of chemical we find in these Sharpie's fibers? Collagen, that's the fiber, okay? Calcium, that's a pretty good guess. Calcium, of course, is important for bones. Calcium makes up the hard nature of a bone, but fibers, anytime you see a fiber, you should think of collagen or reticular fibers, which are really weak, or maybe, what's the third kind of fiber? Elastic fibers, but these Sharpie's fibers are collagen fibers. All right, so lining each one of these right here is the endosteum. All right, one last thing before we go. Notice this line right here. This line is separating the epiphysis from the diaphysis, and this is what we call the epiphyseal line. And during development, this is not bone. It is cartilage, and that's the area that a bone grows in length. So bone will grow in length at this proximal epiphyseal plate, and there's one down over here in the distal epiphysis. So if this epiphyseal plate is damaged when you're growing up, what happens to bone growth in that particular bone? It's going to be attenuated or stunted, or maybe it won't grow at all. All right, so that's the function of this epiphyseal line. It's cartilage. And what is a stronger kind of tissue, cartilage or bone? Bone is pretty strong, but cartilage is easily damaged. So unfortunately, right, during development, this epiphyseal plate can be damaged by compression. And probably everybody's favorite activity for damaging these epiphyseal plates is, like, for instance, when you're swinging on a swing, and what do you like to do? Okay, you like to go really high, and every once in a while you go, oh, well, let's jump off when it's really, really high. And that's great because you can go flying through the air and you're flying for about a second, but the bad thing is you got to land, right? And that puts a lot of compression, axial compression on the bones, which can damage these epiphyseal plates right here. And if you land harder on one side of your body than the other, you might damage epiphyseal plates in some limbs on the left side of your body, but not the right side. So what's going to happen then? The bones on the left side won't grow, but the ones on the right side will grow normally, so one leg will be shorter than the other. And then you need a lift in one shoe to kind of balance your skeletal system out. All right. So don't forget, next time, what's the most important thing you need? A good eraser. Oh, I forgot the signing sheet. Okay.